Andrew Rennie is with you now for another Space Orbit Into the Space Show.
And a big thank you to Sandra Spencer, TechLoad, great program. Now, welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie, and on the console in Mission Control, we have Jay. On this evening's Space Show, well, it may be small, but it is a giant leap forward for the Melbourne Space Program. We discuss the Acrux 1 satellite with Blake Fuller. We talk deep space tracking with one of the original Tidbinbilla trackers. Gary Elphinstone joins us later in the show to remember the glory days when Neil made that small step. But what of the big leap forward to Mars? Question mark. Here's a little message from one of our fans.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon. And you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is the Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
In a few moments, I'm going to introduce Blake Fuller of the Melbourne Space. In fact, why don't I do it now? Blake Fuller of the Melbourne Space Program is with us. Welcome to the show, Blake.
Hi, great to be here.
Now, we've got a little thing about your objectives here, so why don't we let it run?
Gather round, people, I'll tell you a story. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. Well, Blake, from little things, big things grow. Now, your little thing was what?
So, our little thing was Acrux 1. It's a 1 kilogram cube satellite. So, it's about the size of maybe half a loaf of bread.
Okay, and you have a group called the Melbourne Space Program. Who are they?
Right, so the Melbourne Space Program is an organization, a volunteer organization here in Melbourne. We're at about 60 volunteer members working to develop the next generation of space pioneers.
Okay, and where are you based?
So we've got a little office in the city on Exhibition Street at the moment. The program was founded out of the University of Melbourne probably about 4 or 5 years ago, and back then it was just a student club, and so, you know, we used to be on the university, but now 3 years ago we became, you know, separate as this volunteer organization, then moved out to our office on Exhibition Street.
Okay. That reminds me that 50 years ago, there was a group at Melbourne University, a group of students who said, "Yeah, watching videos from NASA is a bit boring. Let's build a satellite." And guess what? They
did it. So yeah. Oscar 5?
Yeah, Oscar 5 or Australis Oscar A, depending on who you talk to.
Who you ask. That's right. And so they launched. It was in 1970.
Yeah, it was the first Australian satellite to be built, but it wasn't launched until 1970. So next year, 2020, we'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary. No, 60th anniversary. 50th. I can't do my maths now. Anniversary of that. Anyway, here we are. You folks come along 50 years later and you build a satellite.
That's right. Yeah, so we've been working on it probably seriously for about 3 years now. And so the vision and the goal of the space program is, you know, we've identified that, you know, Australia is growing in space. And so what we're trying to do with the Melbourne Space Program is develop the next generation of space pioneers. So we're trying to foster the culture and generate the people who have got an interest in space and also the ability to develop space technology.
And so do you do any other activities or just build satellites?
Just build satellites.
Right.
Okay. It's not now, a small thing.
Now, we mentioned a CubeSat. Explain again, what is a CubeSat?
So what companies and NASA specifically found out in the last decade is that with the technology shrinking and shrinking, getting smaller, there's a lot more missions that could go into space of smaller size. So they decided to standardize nano satellites. And so they developed the CubeSat standard. So you've got 1U, 2U, 3U, 6 and 12U satellites, which is a standardized kind of size to make it easy to launch these satellites into space.
Yes. So milk cartons aren't cubic, but imagine something the size of a milk carton, and that's what a CubeSat is. And your ACRUC satellite, was it 1U. 1U. So it's 10 centimetres by 10 centimetres by
10 centimetres.
Now, if you think that's insignificant, you wait until Blake tells us about what they can do. So, ACRUX 1, how did you get the name?
So, the name for ACRUX 1, the brightest star in the Southern Cross is called ACRUX.
Alpha Crucis, yes.
That's right, because it's the brightest star in the southern the sky. So obviously we named ourselves after that, thinking that we can lead the way for other people in space.
Good one. And, of course, the Southern Cross is dear to the hearts of all people who live in the Southern Hemisphere, but particularly us Australians. Hmm. Now, what's its purpose?
So primarily...
Other than, you know, for you to learn how to build a satellite.
Well, actually, that's the first mission, right? Learn how to build a satellite and show that with a bunch of volunteers here in Australia, we can put something into space. Obviously, if there's been 50 years before someone else has done it, you really have to prove that out first. So primarily, we were trying to do that. Then the next goal that we had is we developed this technology called a magnetorque orientation control system. Now, that's a bunch of words, a bunch of complex words. But basically, when you're in space, you have to be able to point your satellite in different directions. And so there's three main techniques to do this. One is with a flywheel. So you basically spin up a mass and then you spin in the other direction and then you can point yourself. That's what the Hubble Space Telescope uses. Then another way is you can use gas thrusters. So you push out gas in one direction and your satellite moves in the other way. And then the third mechanism that we're using is called magnetorquers. So you generate a magnetic field with electromagnets, and that pushes off the Earth's magnetic field to push yourself around in space.
Okay. The first ones that used magnetic orientation, they had permanent magnets in them, didn't they?
That's right, yep.
Yeah. And so, but yours is electromagnetic.
That's right. So you have to know where the Earth's magnetic field is, where you are, and where you want to point.
Okay, because the Earth's magnetic field is like a bar magnet magnetic field, isn't it?
That's right. So it changes depending on where you are. And especially if you get close to the poles of the Earth, the magnetic field gets really strange there.
Okay. So it's not a simple matter. So you built this thing. It must have been fairly expensive to build, even though it is a small satellite.
So you'd actually be amazed, you know, if obviously...
Okay, let's say billions of dollars. Nah, that can't be right. Several million dollars?
Not several millions of dollars.
No.
Getting hotter.
Hundreds of thousands?
Hotter, but still less.
Okay.
So to design and build this thing, it was the actual, you know, to build the physical thing, not talking about fees and to launch costs and things like that, was less than $100,000.
Well, so, if I want to put a satellite up, I can't just sort of throw it in the air and have it gone. I've got to go through permit processes. What were they?
Well, so satellites are considered a defense technology because you know, obviously the history of space is founded in the Cold War, and there's defensive technologies you can use in space. Mm-hmm. And so Australia and the States and the international bodies consider space technologies as weapons. And so you have to prove to the Australian defense organizations that you're not producing a weapon. So obviously there's this huge regulatory process that you have to go with. And one of the steps was proving that you don't have nuclear capability. So we were a bunch of student volunteers were audited on this. And so we had someone from the government come into our little office and ask if we had nuclear capability. And she took one look around and she said, no, you don't have nuclear capability.
They didn't find a radium watch, an old radium watch lying around somewhere.
Oh, thank goodness not.
Okay, so you built your satellite, which is no easy task. Is it actually harder or easier to build a CubeSat than it is to build one of those great big 10-ton monsters that you see being launched by America and Russia and Europe?
So the thing with the huge satellites is that because they're so expensive, they're making everything, you know, triple fault redundant. So if anything fails, you know, if one battery fails, obviously the whole satellite can't fall over. So they make them hugely complex, which then that's why these satellites cost billions of dollars. And so the good thing about the smaller satellites is because it's cheaper, you don't have to put in so much advanced technology and so much redundancy. So obviously there's huge challenges in that. But what we're seeing is that the industry is moving more towards these nanosatellites, these CubeSats, because they're smaller. And because they're cheaper and there's less cost to put more of them up.
And you can still do lots of things with these satellites, can't you?
That's exactly right. So because, you know, electronics and batteries are getting so much smaller now, you can do, you know, in a 1U cube satellite, a 1 kilogram satellite, you can do what, you know, satellites in the 80s that were tons could do because the electronics are getting so small.
I've seen photos of Melbourne, for example, where you can see the cars on the road, and these were taken by a CubeSat.
That's right. Think about how good the camera on your phone is.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Okay, so technology has moved on. Now, what about getting it into space? Who do I go to get my satellite into space?
So there's a lot of companies in the world who do this. There's some European companies. Obviously, you can launch with Russia. India now has a fantastic launch vehicle, which people are starting to use. Rocket Lab in New Zealand is another option. And so if you're spending tens or hundreds of million dollars, you can go and talk to these companies directly. If you don't, you sometimes have to go through third parties. So there's a broker of sorts. Who'll then go and talk to those companies for you. But what we're seeing with nanosatellites and cube satellites coming about is that companies like Rocket Lab out of New Zealand, they're targeting this industry, and so you can go directly to them. It's almost like using the Uber app on your phone. You go onto their website, and they've got a book rocket button, and you can go on there and almost register online. That's how accessible this technology is getting.
Oh, incredible. So who did you go to in the end?
So in the end, we went through a third party, and we were originally going to launch on SpaceX, but then we had to change at the last minute because of the orbit was wrong for what they were doing, and so we had to change to Rocket Lab. So in the end, we launched in New Zealand.
Hmm. And did you go over there for the launch?
I didn't. I was the stress head looking at the computers, making sure we were getting the right signals back.
So you were back here in Melbourne?
Yeah, that's right. We had four other members over there with the champagne, having a good time.
Okay. And what date was it launched?
Oh, 29th of June. The thing is, the classic rocket launches, you get delayed and delayed and delayed. We're actually going to launch in January, but 29th of June this year is when we ended up launching.
Yes, yeah. It's now in orbit, separated from the rocket. How do you find it? I mean, you're looking at something about the size of a liter of milk, and space is big, really big. So how on earth are you going to find such a tiny thing?
It's a huge problem, actually. And this comes back to, you know, everyone talks about space junk. People have a lot of trouble finding stuff. So how we did it in the end is the rocket company tells you where about they think it is. Obviously, they don't have very precise measurements because they can't know because, you know, you get deployed out after them. So they give you an estimate and you say, oh, I think it's about there. And then with your, you have a ground station on the ground and you point up at the satellite where you think it is. And then as it goes overhead, there's something called Doppler shift, which is basically you can use this technology to look at how the satellite beacons out. You listen to the satellite, and from the sound of the satellite, you can see where it is. Similar to, you know, when the when an ambulance is passing past your car and you can hear the tone change, you use a similar technique to track our satellite. That's right.
Okay. So did you have trouble finding it?
So the first opportunity that we had for it to go overhead, it went over and we should have heard from it the first time, but we actually didn't. And so that could have been something wrong with us or with where we could find it. So we didn't find it the first time, but we waited an hour and a half until it orbited the Earth and came back over Melbourne, and then we heard from it the second time.
That was lucky.
Yeah, very lucky. So we are on the day. The funny thing is our ground station actually didn't work on the day. We had problems with our ground station, and thankfully, there's this community in Australia, but also around the world called Satnogs, basically space geeks like us who love these things, and they actually heard from it first. So the first message I got from our satellite was from someone on a message in Twitter. Okay. So that's the modern world for you, hey?
Now, I would point out that sitting in the studio here is Gary Alpingston, and he is a tracker, space tracker, from ages away, and he was nodding sympathetically with you. Welcome to the Space Show, Gary.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And you'd have some empathy then with these young students trying to find their satellite.
I do, very much so, especially when you talk about Twitter. We didn't have Twitter in our day, but that's fantastic. I'm mind-blowing what you've done. Absolutely.
Yeah, fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that technology was apparent in our time, and our miniaturization was quite tremendous at that time. But now, when you look at it, you can put it in your pocket and walk down and launch it off a rocket, I suppose, something like that.
We had a satellite in carry-on luggage to get it to the rocket.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, we couldn't put Surveyor in the luggage, I know that for a start. But I understand, you know, acquiring your technology in space, there's no different today to what it was in our day. It's extremely, extremely hard and very difficult to find because of the actual measurement of all the interference plus that tiny little signal somewhere there. So congratulations, you're doing well.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. It's a huge group effort by a lot of people.
Yes, that's good. Yeah. Pity we didn't have you in our day.
Well, the hope is there's more and more people doing this in Australia.
Yeah.
Well, Blake, what has your satellite found out?
So so a lot of it was about proving that the temperature would stay right and that we could charge up the batteries. And so we had 4 or 5 days of good data, and so obviously the first thing you do is make sure that the satellite's healthy and that it's operating properly, and so we were happy with that. But we had this issue with the amount of energy we were getting from the solar panels. We were getting less than what we thought, and so we've got this communication problem with it at the moment. So what we're trying to do is send a message from a ground station in Germany to the satellite, tell it to go to sleep in Germany, and then as it orbits the Earth, in the sun, it charges up, and then when it's over Australia, we send a message and say, hey, wake up and send us the data. And then that's when we can try and look at, you know, this magnetic system that I just talked about.
Oh. Yeah. And does it do anything else other than this orientation?
So the orientation is mainly what we're trying to prove out. Right. And so if that works, then obviously this is a proof of concept, and we'll talk about, you know, this is one footstep in many footsteps.
Great. Now, how long will it operate? First of all, tell us, how high is it above the Earth?
So it's at 450 kilometres, so higher than you can throw a stone. So up at 450 kilometres.
Which is why you needed the rocket to get it up there. And how long will it keep operating for?
So it'll be about 3 years, and then after 3 years it'll naturally decay and then burn up in the atmosphere.
Oh, okay. I thought it was going to be a bit sooner, and I was a bit surprised when I misheard you when you said, I thought you said 3 or 4 months.
No, years.
Oh, great. So you're going to be kept busy for a while then?
That's right, absolutely.
You yourself was a student when it started.
Actually, I'd graduated about a year and a half before the program had started.
Okay. So I was just going to say, after these students, having built this skill, are now going to be moving on into industry. What have you done?
So I was actually just on the previous program talking about my experience in medtech. So I've been in medtech for almost 5 years now. I'm developing medical technologies that improve humans' lives. And so, you know, the technology that you use in space is the same technology that you use in medtech. So, you know, a lot of people say, why do you spend so much money in space? And the reason really is that there's huge amounts of benefits in technology and other advancements that you can use in Earth. And so my day-to-day job is using the same technologies that was developed in space, but for medical technologies.
Okay. So what's next for the Melbourne Space Program?
So mission one down, you know, we've solved this. We know that it works. The next program, so we've got two missions coming up, both looking at how we can help in the same vision that the Australian Space Agency has in across different sectors, like looking at space debris, looking at GPS, and then looking at Earth observation. And so I think Earth observation is where we're really going to start going and putting our next two missions into that area. So looking at, you know, drought in Australia from space, looking at how you can monitor fires. And so there's a few different missions that we're looking at now for that.
Oh, well done. Well, Blake, we'll get you back on the show in a little bit on to talk about the future. But let's go now. We've got some station announcements to do.
Actually, before
before
we get to station announcements, I would like to backtrack a little bit. How long have you been interested in space as an industry of as something you'd like to do?
I think I was born like this. I sometimes think why is this way? And I think there are some people who are born like this. But I think what's really important and what really pushed me into the industry is looking at science communication and people talking about science and physics. And so, you know, through university especially, really amplified that.
Fair enough. And with that being said, how high did you jump when the Australian Space Agency was announced?
Actually, I thought, thank goodness, because we're fighting this battle by ourselves. And the whole time we're doing, we said, if only there was a space agency. And so I hope that, you know, for the next people who try and do this, and for us, frankly, the next time is going to be a lot easier. So I think, if nothing else, the Space Agency offers that support for everyone else to be able to, you know, enable their missions.
So have you been looking into collaborating with them?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're definitely in touch with them, looking at their missions and their vision.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where you're listening to The Space Show.
Mission control. Everything is ready to roll. The president's here to give his regards. Everybody's trying real hard. You know that this is mission control. Everybody's ready to roll. This is mission control. Check the valve on your air hose. This is mission control. Everything is ready to go. We hope you boys will come home soon. Tonight you're going to fly to the moon. This is Mission Control.
This is Mission Control. That's a song by John Phillips. It was produced by none other than Andy Warhol, which some of the older members will remember. Now, if you can hear some music in the background, that's because Mark Kovalov next door in our other studio, the Red Studio, is got some musos in there, and they're getting ready for their show at 8 o'clock, Purple Haze at 8 o'clock. Well, joining us again is Gary Elphingstone. He was a comtech at Tidbinbilla, which is near Canberra. And their job was to track all sorts of things in space, particularly those who are in deep space. Welcome again to the Space Show, Gary.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And first of all, we just played a song there about mission control. Most people heard the term mission control. But you weren't in mission control.
No.
You were a tracker.
Mm-hmm.
So explain to the audience, please, what is the difference between a tracker and a mission controller?
Well, basically, mission control is the MSFN network, where Goldstone has the mission control to do anything with a manned space flight. And operational control we had in JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, that was to do with the deep space network. So we were a station that was heavily tasked in deep space network tracking and also the Apollo program. So we had some pretty heavy demands on the crews, or the crew at the time.
And what was your role then and your career that led up to this?
Well, my career came from basically being overseas, working for intelligence. And then when I came back, I worked for the aviation industry and Department of Civil Aviation, part of my love. And then someone told me to come down to the tracking station. I could get a free lunch and have a look at it. So I did. And then 3 weeks later, after I got back, you know, the free lunch was good. I got a telegram asking me if I'd like to join. And a certain person at the Sydney operation where I was in DCA said, go for it. So I did. So that's where I started. And that was back in 1966. No free meals after that, by the way.
Okay. Now, we said that you worked at Tidman Billa. Mm. And a tracking, particularly the Apollo missions, there was Parkes, Radio Telescope, Honeysuckle Creek, Tidman Billa, where you were, and Carnarvon. Could you quickly explain what each of these were doing?
Well, Parkes initially was not involved, and Parkes came later on, as I think most people would be aware. Carnarvon was very heavily involved in the close tracking of any of the spacecraft. In other words, when they came around on their first orbit around the Earth, etc., because of the speed of it, and they had a 35-foot antenna for that particular mission. Now, Honeysuckle was a Apollo manned space flight network station, and Tidman Billa had a wing which was made up as a supplementary and also a backup to Honeysuckle. So in each station network, for instance, we had Goldstone. They had a wing too. We had Madrid. They had a wing also. And then we had, in Canberra, we had the Honeysuckle plus Tidman Billa, and that was the wing there for the Apollo program.
Yeah. But the main task of Tidman Billa, obviously involved in Apollo, but its main task was deep space.
Yes.
What does deep space mean? We've heard Blake talking about low Earth orbit and so on.
Yeah. Deep space is really, deep space. We're talking of programs at the time like Mariner. We're talking about...
Which went to Venus and Mars.
That's right. And we're talking programs like Surveyor, which we put onto the lunar surface to test the soil and all that. And five of those missions were successful. They took a tremendous amount of time. And we had Pioneer, which went out to deep space environment, exploring the... you're around the very deep planetary area. Planetary area. And, of course, the Apollo, too, which we switched back onto. It's hard to explain, but we're talking about a big time difference when you get into deep space or when you send a signal to when you get a signal back, and also the strength of that signal is extremely, extremely small. I think the best way to explain it in the LEM, it wouldn't even run a shaver, electric shaver at the time. And I think someone said it's something like a fly crawling up a wall, taking 3 weeks to get there is the amount of energy we would receive into our antenna. So that gives you some very, basic.
Yes, I know that reading the statistics of some of the transmitting power of some of those deep space missions, they were less than the light bulbs in this room here, in the studio. Mm. And yet you could detect that way out billions of kilometres away.
That's right. And, of course, you can imagine the pointing of the actual antenna and the time and all the calculations for that was very important, which I'm sure my friend here who's doing the CubeSat wouldn't appreciate.
Mm. So how did Tidman Biller get involved in the Apollo program, considering that the main task was at Honeysuckle Creek?
Honeysuckle Creek was built as an Apollo station, and Tidman Biller had a wing, which was another Apollo station, which worked in with Honeysuckle. So when you look at the program and you look at these command service module, that's one item. Then you look at the LEM, which is the Lunar Excursion Module. That's another item. So you need two tracking stations to handle those two signals coming in for a start.
Yes, because they weren't necessarily in the same direction.
No, not necessarily. No, no. So it was extremely difficult to separate those signals too. And it backed up. Each station backed each other up. I mean, originally, in Tidman Biller, we were the prime station for Apollo 11, but about 2 days before, this is on July the 18th, one of our transmitters failed. So we had to go off and the Honeysuckle had to be prime. Now, at the same time, we fixed that transmitter in less than probably a day and a half, which is tremendous. But it's not reliable enough to take the Lunar Excursion Module to the moon. We then took on the Command Service Module. So we tracked that all the time while it went around the moon.
Mm. And what exactly does tracking mean in that sense?
Well, it's taking all the bio data. It's taking the telemetry. It's taking positions. It's taking, you know, the temperatures. It's taking heartbeats. And it just goes on and on and on. It's massive, absolutely massive amount of telemetry coming down.
But it also involves saying where the spacecraft is and how far away it is, how fast it's moving.
And that was mentioned before when Andrew was talking about Doppler system, and that's where that system was developed. And that's very accurate down in our time, down to about 2 metres, and we're talking about deep space, and 2 metres is not very much when you think about the distance involved, even though the moon's a quarter of a million away.
It's 400,000 kilometres.
Yes.
Okay. You must have some memories of each of those Apollo missions. What was the first Apollo one you worked on?
Well, we didn't actually work on it. We were preparing, and that was Apollo 1. And that really set the industry back on its tail, and the sad loss of those three astronauts on the ground or in the command.
So you were getting ready to track Apollo 1?
Well, we were preparing for all that, yes. That was all part of the build-up to it.
Should point out to to our listeners that the Apollo 1 fire happened in January, and the launch was supposed to happen about 3 weeks after the fire.
That's
on the launch pad.
Yes. So we were building up to all that. There are many systems, et cetera, you know, checking and trials and everything else. But unfortunately that happened. And, well, it turned out changed the whole mission profile completely from pure oxygen. It changed the whole thing. And I think that was very fortunate in that sense. But you imagine in space anything happens, it's very, very difficult to recover.
So in the, nearly 2 years before the next mission, which was Apollo 7, the next manned mission, you would have done a lot of improvements to the station and your skill at doing things?
Oh, we're still trained and we still use system trials and everything else, but at the same time, we're heavily involved in the deep space network, so we weren't lost for work, I can assure you.
Yes. And, of course, the Apollo 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 missions, which were unmanned, were you involved in tracking those?
No. Not as far as I can recall. But there again, you've got to remember that we're very heavily focused on the deep space network. Mm. Honeysuckle may have. I don't have a memory of it.
Okay, so you were busy tracking the surveyors and things
like that. Yes, that's right. Mm. And that was very important for the Apollo mission as to how soft the LEM was going to land on the surface.
Mm. Mm. One interesting thing is that at the same time that Apollo 11 was landing on the moon, going to and from the moon, there were two spacecraft, unmanned spacecraft, going past Mars. Tell us about those, please.
Well, that's a very hard one to remember. We could not track at the same time when we were switched over to Apollo. So a lot of that tracking, there was overlap between Madrid and Goldstone and other areas, and they probably picked up a bit of it. But I can't recollect us doing any of that deep space while we're on Apollo. It was totally Apollo because the station had to be switched over, so it just couldn't do it. So,
well, I clearly remember that the news of Mariner 6 and 7, they were called, was very much almost forgotten. But some newspapers, to their credit, did publish, along with the Apollo photographs and details, stories about Mariner 6 and 7 and some of the first detailed pictures of Mars. There had been Mariner 4 earlier, which had sent back some crude pictures, I think 21 blurry photographs of Mars.
Yeah.
You've got a story about that, haven't you?
No, not so much about Mars.
Mariner 4? No?
No. Okay. I think today when we were talking, it was explained how small one pixel took from coming from Mars to make start, how long it took to start the photograph of what we were taking and how many days it took to get a full photograph. And that was quite extraordinary when you think about the distance, etc.
What about the data rates coming down? Today, people look askance if they don't get megabits per second on their internet connection. What sort of data rates were we talking about back then?
Best of my recollection, our high-speed data system was at 2.4 kilobits, and we thought that was fantastic. That's about the highest we got at the time.
And perhaps we bring Blake in on this. From Acrux, what sort of data rates can we get?
Well, that's so funny because, honestly, so you said 2.4?
Yes.
So we were getting 9.6 kilobits per second as well. So it's not that much faster than what you were getting.
No.
So, but that's the thing, you know, you can still use exactly that same technology, but you know, obviously with ours, we had the option to make that 10 times faster, but we didn't need anything quicker. But, you know, like Andrew was saying, the data rates that you can get now, you know, satellites, you know, think about satellite phones and satellite internet. You know, you can be on Antarctica and be getting megabits per second.
Right. Yeah, Gary, you're interested in setting up some sort of contact group for the people who were working at Tidbinbilla?
Yes, we're, well, I suppose we could use the saying we're a dying breed. We're getting a bit older. Yes, there's not many of us left, and I'd like to be able to get some of the trackers and their families and make some base where we could all put down some of the stories that we experienced during our time of tracking. And well, hopefully we can get that up and running in the next couple of months, and we'll see how we go. And we're looking forward to working with the association with that and see what we can bring together, because some of these trackers we haven't heard from for a long time, but we do know they're out there.
Yeah, okay. So if you're listening and you were a tracker, or you know someone who was a tracker at Tidbinbilla, then you can get in contact with the Space Association at www.space.asn.au. So www.space.asn.au. And in the last minute or so, the future. Where do you think humans, either manned or unmanned, should be going in the future?
Well, I think the closest thing of any manned space flight is going to be the lunar again. But I personally have very strong views about going any further from there. There's too many things to be solved. And I think it's a bit of a mission where we're going to have loss of life, which I don't think is acceptable in this day and age. And I think we've got to slow down to getting more focus onto deep space network.
And Blake, your view?
I think I'm going to have to oppose you.
I think
I think we need to push the boundary. You need to always look at where the boundary is and push it further and further. Me personally, I look to the future and I think we need to have humans exploring space, and we need to become a spacefaring civilization. I think it's a natural progression for us, and I think it's inspiring to think that that's something that we can do. So for me, we need to push space.
Okay, that's good.
Well,
I just got to add one thing. I think that initially we should take more time to do that exploration.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, thank you to our guests on the Space Show. Over now to Purple Haze.